From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, understanding the chaos and violence in Iraq. We talk with Anthony Shadid of the Washington Post. He's fluent in Arabic and he's traveled throughout Iraq, visiting a Sunni town to understand why villagers attacked a U.S. convoy and talking with recruits for the Iraqi police. His new book is Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. Also, actress Mariska Hargitay. Since taking her role as a sex crimes detective on Law & Order SVU, she started her own nonprofit aiding victims of rape. We'll talk with her about her work on and off the screen and about her famous mother, the late Jane Mansfield. Also, TV critic David Biancooley tells us about his favorite new TV shows. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. In less than a month, Iraqis are scheduled to vote on a new constitution, followed by voting for a permanent government in a few months. But the insurgency has stepped up its attacks, killing 250 people in 4 days last week. Four more American soldiers were killed in Iraq today, bringing the death toll among U.S. troops to 1,904. Conditions are also perilous for journalists. In the southern city of Basra, an Iraqi journalist who worked for the New York Times and other media organizations was found murdered yesterday. My guest, Anthony Shadid, has been in Iraq for most of the past 2.5 years, covering the war for the Washington Post. An Arab-American of Lebanese descent, Shadid is fluent in Arabic. His insightful reporting on the war and the sentiments of ordinary Iraqis won him the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. Shadid's new book is called Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. Anthony Shadid, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now, one of the things that you describe early in the book is the Iraq of the 1970s, before it was, you know, gripped by Saddam Hussein's madness, and the power of the memory of that Iraq on many of the people that you interviewed. What was it that Iraqis told you about that era that was so powerful?
I think there's a strong sense of memory, of nostalgia in Iraq, and especially in Baghdad. I think some of that nostalgia goes back to what Baghdad was in the Middle Ages, when it was probably, you know, the most glorious city in the world for centuries. And that kind of historic memory of what Baghdad was plays a big role, I think, in people's lives. And I think what we saw in the 1970s was a miniature version of that. In the 1970s, you saw a country that had a standard of living similar to the poor countries in Europe. There was a lot of optimism. There was kind of almost a brash sense to the place. Oil was fueling development, education, infrastructure. And for the first time, I think, in decades, maybe even centuries, I think a lot of Iraqis saw the future as something that was going to be better, not worse. This is the very beginning of Saddam's rule, in a way, and it was before the war began with Iran. I think people look back. I think it plays such a big role today in Iraq because people... there was a certain anticipation, a certain hope that once Saddam was gone, they were going to see a replay of the 1970s, a replay of that optimism and that hope that oil revenues would again fuel this kind of development of the country. And I think that's what made the disappointment so much stronger, so much starker in a way, was that it didn't follow. And so, you know, people do refer back to the 1970s, but I think they refer to it as much, you know, they refer back to it as much as a way of saying what they don't have now is what they had then.
Yeah, I remember one Iraqi told you of that period back then, in 5 years, Baghdad will look like Chicago. And so they wanted to get back to that point after the Americans came in and removed their dictator. Didn't happen.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think the Americans often, even in those first months after the war, they would talk about electricity, or they would talk about water or sewage or something, and they would use their standard as what Iraq had right before the U.S. invasion. Just, you know, a few months before. You know, that wasn't Iraqis. I think for a lot of Iraqis, that wasn't their standard. Their standard was what they had 20 years before, 25 years before. I think in a lot of ways, the Americans and the Iraqis were working on two different scales of what progress meant.
One of the things I think your book does is illuminate the roots of the insurgency, which has so mystified many Americans. And a couple of stories seemed so revealing. One of them involved a U.S. military operation in the summer of 2003, not so long after Saddam fell, called Operation Peninsula Strike, and involved an incursion into Sunni villages. Describe this experience from the perspective of the villagers who were there.
You know, this is a town called Dhulariya, and it was a town that wasn't unsympathetic to Saddam. I think it was, in a lot of ways, it was a window on why Saddam had a certain level of support in Sunni regions. It was a village that wasn't necessarily impoverished, but it wasn't all that, you know, wasn't well-to-do. Saddam had come in there, had given jobs. A lot of people worked for intelligence. They worked in the military. They worked in the ministries. There was a certain kind of prosperity that had come with its incorporation within the Iraqi government under Saddam. So the village wasn't too bad off. There were suspicions there that either the Ba'ath Party was still organizing, or that some, you know, that even some attacks might have been organizing out of this village, and the Americans went in. And at the time, the American military went in with what was a pretty big display of force. They went in after nightfall, and they stormed these houses, I think, if I remember right, there's about a half dozen houses that they had been tipped off to by informers. And now informers is kind of, especially at that time, was a very sketchy thing. I mean, it was often people settling scores, people interested in maybe making a little bit of money on the side by, you know, pointing out people that might not have been doing anything, but that, you know, could be suspicious, or people that were actually doing something and they had heard about it. You know, that military operation struck me in so many ways because I saw so much captured in those couple of days. I mean, there was one moment that I was being told about by villagers when the soldiers started yelling at them, and they had no idea what the soldiers were saying. The soldiers were speaking English; they only spoke Arabic, and there were these two sides shouting at each other, having, you know, no idea what the other side was saying. And then what followed were these arrests. Thousands of people actually picked up over time. Often they were, you know, sometimes they were picked up because they had done bad things. Often they were picked up and they hadn't done anything, but they were still kept for months and months. And there was a sense of indignity about it, a sense of injustice on the part of, I think, those villagers. And you especially saw that in this town, Dhul-Ruayya. People feeling that they were innocent and they were, you know, they'd been treated wrongly, that the soldiers had come into their houses, that they had stolen things, that they had torn the place up, that they, I mean, it's a very traditional, very conservative place, so men would enter into rooms where only the women were allowed. And it even got to the point where you would see these very concrete instances where you could see where the misunderstandings would occur. But then you create an atmosphere and an environment in which everything is perceived through this lens of offense, where everything is perceived through this lens of an occupier and occupied, a more powerful and a less powerful. And I think that became very quickly this sense of paranoia, this sense of deep distrust and suspicion about the American presence, about what the Americans were doing in these places.
And what was the impact of these events on the villagers and ultimately upon the insurgency?
Well, you know, I think it's a good question. And if you look at Dhul-Ruayya today, it's basically a no-go zone. I mean, no reporter. I haven't been back there in a year now, and I think if you went there, you would be taking unbelievable risks. It's one of these villages that we see in certain parts of the Sunni Triangle that is pretty much turned over to insurgents or opposition or resistance, or however you want to describe it, but is pretty much turned over to those people fighting the Americans. I mean, I always ask myself this question: was that inevitable? And I don't know the answer to that. I mean, if things like Operation Peninsula Strike hadn't happened in the beginning, would this village somehow be different today? You know, perhaps, or, you know, the others, you know, I guess I also think that maybe it was inevitable that you would have these resentments, that as long as there was an American military presence in that area, you would have these slights and these frustrations and these resentments and anger that would eventually build over time. But Dhul-Ruayya is it's a rough town right now.
And there was a remarkable follow-up story here where a controversy arose after this U.S. military operation about the young man who was suspected of having been an informer to the U.S. military forces. What happened to him?
You know, it all grew out of that same operation, this Operation Peninsula Strike. I'd mentioned earlier that that there were informers that were tipping the Americans off to suspects, or, you know, sometimes they were suspects, sometimes, you know, people were just settling scores. But there was one person in particular that had tipped the U.S. military off to several houses. It was a guy named Sabah. And people recognized him pretty quickly, that it was Sabah. He was wearing a mask at the time. But even within a few days, it had made the rounds of the village that there was a person among them who had been tipping the Americans off. They knew his name. They knew his family. And I remember asking a person, kind of an acquaintance I had in that village, what's going to happen to him. And he was pretty blunt to me. He said, you know, they're going to kill him. And at the time, I thought it was bluster. I didn't think much of it. But I would go back to Dhul-Ruayya in those months and just check back. And I remember, I think it was the second or third trip after that, and I'd asked what happened to them. And they told me that he was, not only had he been killed, but villagers have forced his family, actually his father, to kill him. And, you know, as over the next couple of days, I reported the story, and it was probably, you know, to this day, I think when I think back on that story, it's hard to describe. I don't, you know, it's one of the most, in some ways, one of the most painful stories I've ever reported, in the sense that the villagers gave a choice that I don't know how most people would answer to this father. They said either you kill your son for working as an informer for the Americans, or we kill your family. And so a father is faced with a choice of actually killing his son or losing the rest of his family to villagers who are very serious about meting out their own justice. You know, he chose the former, and he and his other son, once the informer Sabah had returned to the village, I think I think it was 3 or 4 weeks later, they woke him up one night and took him behind the house and basically executed him.
And this father, who was confronted with the choice of killing his own son or facing the retribution of his fellow villagers, was there any thought that he could have turned to a coalition government, which, you know, ostensibly was there to impose, you know, some sort of law and due process? Was there any thought that he could have had any, you know, any redress, any due process from the authorities in Baghdad?
You know, it's difficult to say, and I think especially in those first few months, sometimes it's difficult to convey how arbitrary everything felt in those days. I mean, it was basically a government had collapsed, government that had been in power for, you know, in some form, 35 years. This government collapsed, and the military was charged with creating a new authority almost immediately. And basically what you saw in those days was not much of authority. And so Sabah, this former, had been taken with the Americans. They actually took him up to Crete. And, you know, my understanding, I didn't get a lot of cooperation from the military on this story, but my understanding was they just let him go because they didn't know what to do with him. And he made his way back to relatives and then all the way back down to Thuluia. You know, I had asked the military in Thuluia, I think a couple of months later, if they had heard about the case, and they had not heard about it. And then once I asked them about it, I think they did look into it, and they, there's one of those really strange circumstances in Iraq. They found out that it was true, and they actually went after the father, and the father, knowing that the Americans were after him, turned to the same villagers who had forced him to kill his son for protection, and those villagers hid him or, you know, kept him from the Americans, and my understanding was he was never arrested.
My guest is Anthony Shadid. His new book is called Night Draws Near. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is Anthony Shadid. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post. He speaks fluent Arabic, and his reporting in Iraq was the basis of his new book. It's called Night Draws Near. One of the things the U.S. says is that the United States says is that it can't leave Iraq until Iraqis are able to handle their own security, and this is often described as a matter of recruiting and training Iraqi police and security forces and military forces. You spent some time talking to Iraqi policemen and people who work with them and interact with them. What did you hear from Iraqi police about their motivation, how that's going?
It was such a stark, you know, I think it was when journalism can be good is when you can see that there's one, you know, we talk about one thing, which is training the Iraqi army, and then we actually understand what's going on the ground. And I think we saw what was going on the ground in this instance. And not that it was representative of the entire country. I don't want to, you know, claim that. But it was a very bleak picture on the ground. I remember, you know, I'd spent time with them in their barracks, and, you know, they were sleeping on concrete or the ground. Their tents were, you know, it was 120, 130 degree heat. Water came out of a kind of a tanker that they used for both drinking and showering.
And this is the Iraqi forces, right, who see American soldiers in very different conditions, right?
That's right. In fact, they were very aware of the Americans, you know, living in air-conditioned kind of barracks with good food. I mean, you know, I think the Americans said, well, you know, this is an Iraqi army that we're just trying to get off the ground. Of course the conditions are going to be worse for them. The Iraqis saw, they looked over, you know, they looked across the fence and they thought, well, we should have everything they have. And so it, you know, created a certain resentment at a certain level. I think what was bleaker in some ways was, you know, was spending time with them as they actually went on patrol. And, you know, what struck me time and again in these interviews was that you would ask the question what they were fighting for, and they couldn't answer it. I don't think they really had a clear sense of what they were fighting for. In fact, one guy, I think he was 18, told me they were fighting for what they had before the invasion. And he wasn't speaking in political terms or ideological terms. He was just, you know, what was before the invasion was security, was stability, was a steady income, and they wanted that back. Now, Beji is a village that's north of Tikrit. It's Sunni Muslim, it's Arab, and it is, you know, it's it's representative in some ways of areas where the insurgency is happening. You wouldn't hear that same answer if you were in the South or in predominantly Shiite Muslim areas. But I don't think that sentiment that he was expressing to me was all that rare in these areas, in these Sunni areas around Beijing or you know, out west. In fact, we were going on patrol with them. I remember that it was at 4 or 5 in the morning, and the Americans were in front, and I was in back with the Iraqis, and you know, they started singing a song about, you know, longing for Saddam. And it was one of those, again, those really strange moments where, you know, you're riding on, you're going toward a raid, a joint American-Iraqi raid, you know, ostensibly to fight, you know, insurgents that might be Baathists, that might be religious, and these guys are singing a song for Saddam. And you know, again, it's one of those moments that they're kind of hard to get out of your mind.
Now, these guys, I assume, were in the Army primarily for the paycheck. What did they do when they actually had to encounter insurgents, or did they hang around?
No, they didn't. In fact, they, you know, there was a couple of instances where they did, you know, they did encounter a fight, and they basically ran and they fled. And you know, I think right off it sounds like cowardice, and I think, you know, part of it is, you know, they didn't have the stomach for a fight. But you know, the other part of it is, again, it comes back to that question that I asked them in the first place, and it's, what are they fighting for? And they really couldn't answer that. You know, in a lot of respects, I think they were fighting for a paycheck of $300 a month, which is pretty good. And why risk your life, you know, for that?
You also spoke to Iraqi police recruits, places, I guess, small towns where there was a police station. And I was struck by one of the Iraqi policemen saying that by being a policeman for the provisional government, he was a bad Muslim. What did that mean?
You know, that was in the same village, actually, in Beijing. And it was a completely different group of people. But, you know, I'd spent a day with them, with a small, probably a dozen soldiers and all. They were protecting the train station in Beijing. And I was asking these questions. I've always been struck by this question in Iraq, and it's legitimacy. And, you know, legitimacy is something that's, you know, far easier to deny than it is to bestow. You know, how do you create a legitimate government? How do you create a government that has legitimacy in the eyes of the people it's supposed to represent? And I think that's been one of the key questions, you know, for the Americans in Iraq, is how do we bring about legitimacy? And legitimacy is usually endangered when there's too great of an American hand. It was around that kind of issue that I was speaking to these guys in Beijing. And, you know, I was asking them, how do you justify working with the Americans? How do you see working with the Americans? How do you think that, what kind of image of you does that create in your village? And it was very tough. I mean, they were accused of being collaborators. They had been attacked in their houses. People had thrown fruit at them in the streets. And then this one guy I was talking to, they had mentioned also that the clerics in the mosques had ridiculed them, had said that they, you know, they could no longer fast during Ramadan, which is a Muslim holy month where you fast from dawn to dusk. They could no longer fast during Ramadan because they were bad Muslims. They were not Muslims because they were working with the Americans. They had become collaborators. And I asked him what he thought about that. And he said, well, it's true. We are bad Muslims. We shouldn't be doing this. It does go against our religion. And it was, again, one of those questions that maybe there isn't an answer to, that question that, you know, faced by the father, you know, either he kills his son or his family is killed. You know, this young 18 or 19 year old recruit who is either, you know, he's either a good Muslim and doesn't work with the Americans, or in his eyes is a good Muslim and doesn't work with the Americans, and sees his family have no money, no livelihood, or he, you know, provides a livelihood for his family and is a bad Muslim. And in fact, one of his friends sat next to him and said, if the cleric in the mosque wants to pay us $300 a month, we're happy to quit. You know, they faced a situation in which there were two bad choices.
You talk to a lot of Iraqis in villages in Sunni areas in the south and Shiite areas and middle-class folks in Baghdad. And I'm wondering, this is a broad question, but how much of a constituency, if any, is there for, you know, the kind of transition the U.S. envisioned, you know, the defeat of Saddam and then temporary occupation leading to a pluralistic Western-style democracy? I mean, is there a constituency, a voice for that role?
Yeah, I think there definitely was a constituency for that. You know, it's difficult to say, and I don't know the answers, and I don't know what should have happened or could have happened. We did see, you know, to a certain degree what did happen, and I guess my sense was that, you know, in a lot of ways the American experience in Iraq was decided in those first few weeks after the U.S. invasion, after the fall of Saddam. I remember waking up the next morning and driving through Baghdad, and you know, Baghdad was a city that wasn't that destroyed during the war. In a lot of ways, especially at the beginning of the invasion, the American military strikes were very precise, and civilian casualties weren't that great. It got a little less precise as the invasion went on. But basically, on the day that Saddam fell, Baghdad was not a destroyed city. And in the weeks that followed, it was destroyed. I think, you know, it wasn't an exaggeration to say that Baghdad was burning at us, you know, in some ways after those.
But the looting and lawlessness, right? Yeah.
That's right, the looting and lawlessness that wrecked the city. And I think Baghdad, you know, so you had this sense of optimism after Saddam's fall, like, okay, finally we're going to reclaim, like we were talking about earlier, this kind of, you know, a shade of the 1970s, and instead what they saw was their city being dismantled. And I think that began this really, the sentiment that you hear often, and that's, you know, and that's hard to provide an answer to, and that's like, how could the American military have been so precise, so effective, so flawless in its execution of the war, and so feeble in its aftermath? And you still hear that point made. I mean, in fact, when I was sitting with a family that I spent a lot of time with, they asked me that same thing 2 years down the road, and you know, at this point, you just shake your head because what is the answer that you give them about that?
Well, Anthony Shadid, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Journalist Anthony Shadid. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the war in Iraq. His new book is Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor Audio Courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actress Mariska Hargitay. Her mother was the sex symbol Jane Mansfield. Her father was Mr. Universe. Now she stars as a detective in Law & Order Special Victims Unit. We'll talk with her about avoiding roles that stereotyped her. Also, TV critic David Biancooley tells us about two new comedies worth watching. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest actress Mariska Hargitay has one of the most recognizable faces on television. She plays Detective Olivia Benson on the hit series Law & Order SVU. SVU stands for Special Victims Unit. In the series, Hargitay and her partners investigate sex crimes, many involving child abuse. Hargitay won a Golden Globe Award this year for Best Dramatic Actress for the role and was nominated for an Emmy. The new season of Law & Order SVU begins tonight on NBC. Let's listen to a scene from last season's Law & Order SVU. In this episode, Hargitay's character, Detective Olivia Benson, is on a statutory rape case stemming from a mother's discovery of her teenage daughter in bed with her 21-year-old boyfriend. Olivia empathizes with the teenage girl. In this scene, she's called into the office of her commander, Captain Cragen,
played by Dan Florek.
Why is Denise Eldridge screaming to 1PP that you talked her daughter out of a rape kit?
Carrie didn't want it.
Now, that's exactly what Simone Bryce told Carrie's mother. It's funny how a children's rights attorney just happened to show up at the ER.
She was there because I called her.
You've got enough on your plate without taking on this kid as a cause.
Well, somebody's got to protect her from that lunatic mother of hers.
Why are you calling her that?
You saw how she humiliated Carrie in front of the entire squad. I don't like her.
Well, she has a right to be upset.
She's upset because she thinks Carrie's going to end up just like her, pregnant without a man.
Denise Eldridge believes a crime was committed against her daughter.
Denise Eldridge is a fruitcake.
Well, Mariska Hargitay, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You played Detective Olivia Benson on Law & Order Special Victims Unit, where you investigate sex crimes, some of the most brutal stuff that cops ever have to encounter. How did you prepare for and research this role?
Well, you never can be completely prepared, I have learned. But when I was cast, I immediately flew to New York and basically tried to make friends with every NYPD officer that I could. I also went to the Special Victims Unit in Manhattan and also the Bronx, and I spent a lot of time with the detectives there, and then made a bunch of buddies in the cold case squad and sort of all over. So I had field trips every day for about 2 weeks before we actually started shooting. And then, you know, through my relationships, I made a couple of friends that I could call and ask questions, and, you know, you're continually studying. I mean, I feel like it's 7 years later, and I'm still studying and still learning and still going to the, you know, shooting range and still trying to figure things out as we go along.
Your character, Detective Olivia Benson, is herself a child of rape. Is that in your head in some way as you create that character?
Always. And I think that's my, you know, sort of super vigilant, protective, you know, lioness aspect that I have to my character. I think I'm, you know, certainly at the beginning in the first few years, I, you know, sort of overzealously needing to protect and, you know, like a one-woman show to end crime in the world. You know, I think that all of us are called to our professions for different reasons and oftentimes emotional reasons. And clearly this is why Olivia Benson became a detective. And there's been shows over the years sort of dealing with why, you know, the positive and the negative, you know, the light side and the dark side.
This is, of course, very tough material. And as you say, drawn from real cases. Is it hard, emotionally hard on you?
Absolutely. I've learned more about sexual assault than I ever wanted to. It is very heavy to know that the stories that we are dealing with are true stories. And that's why I created this website, Mariska.com, because I started to get fan mail, and it was a very different kind of fan mail. It wasn't, you know, hi, you're my favorite actress. But it was a lot of women actually disclosing their story and sharing with me things that they'd never told anyone.
Do you respond directly to these letters, any of them?
I did at the beginning. Unfortunately, I can no longer respond due to the volume of the email that I get. I can't. However, I've teamed up with my various partners with Safe Horizon, and I became a rape crisis counselor. I work with the Rape Treatment Center in L.A. I work with a lot of different programs, and I actually just started my own nonprofit organization. So I have these amazing partners, and so now I have support in answering these emails and trying to find people the help that they need.
We're speaking with Mariska Hargitay. She plays Detective Olivia Benson on the hit TV series Law & Order Special Victims Unit. A lot of our listeners probably don't know that your mother was the actress Jane Mansfield, who was killed tragically in a car accident in 1967 when you were three. Your dad was Mickey Hargitay, who was also an actor and a bodybuilder. Despite having two parents who were celebrities, I gather you really didn't grow up in a show business world. Is that right?
That's right. My dad sort of kept us away from all of that. I mean, I grow up in Los Angeles, California, so, you know, as far as away you can get in Los Angeles, it's sort of a showbiz town. But
right.
I have to say we lived a fairly normal existence, and we spent a lot of time in the summers traveling, and I had no idea that I wanted to go into this business till I was about 18.
I'm sure as you got older, you came to know of your mom through family memories, and it must have been strange because this was an era before there were VCRs, and you probably didn't see a lot of her screen work. But you, mm-hmm. as you got older, you must have encountered a lot of other people who had these, you know, strong images and impressions about this person that you kind of should have known best and had a very different feeling for.
Yeah, that's still going on, actually. It's such a gift because, especially now with the popularity of the show, I get lots of mail from people that knew her. Or actually, today I just received some gorgeous, gorgeous photos of her that I'd never seen before. And it's such a, you know, gift. I don't think these people really realize what a gift that they're giving me, you know, a piece of her life, especially when they're photos I haven't seen, or they'll write a memory, you know, just some one, two, three little sentences about how she touched their lives or how she was kind or funny or, you know, smart. It's a gift. So I'm still getting to know her all these years later. And I you're right, though. I didn't really see her movies as a kid, and quite frankly, I wasn't interested in her screen work. I wanted to know her as a person and how she touched people and what she thought was funny. You know, I had sort of different goals with getting to know her.
You know, I'm a little older than you are, and I remember your mother as an actress. And I in preparing for this interview, I saw the movie Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter, in which you're
so great.
It's a wonderful movie. If anybody has it,
that's a great one.
It's worth getting because it has your mom in a lead role, and then your dad is also in it. Mickey Hargaday is in it,
and I love The Girl Can't Help It. That's the other one. It's great.
Right. Uh huh.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about it was that I sort of my memory of Jane Mansfield was, you know, ditzy, buxom, blonde. But when I saw this and saw the thing that she does, the sort of ooing and cooing with her voice, I was like, you know, that really is hard to do. I mean, it didn't look easy. It looked like a real acting achievement. And I gather you've come to regard her as something of a pre-feminist in a way, somebody who achieved an awful
Absolutely.
Lot.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, she, you know, she was a violinist and she had 160 IQ. She was an extremely, extremely intelligent woman. I have the Life magazine hanging in my house where it says, you know, Hollywood's smartest dumb blonde. You know, she found this niche and she went for it all the way. I think that was her sort of, you know, business plan. And when you talk about pre-feminist, five kids, was a movie star, had animals, husbands. I mean, she did it all. So she lived, you know, a very full life. Unfortunately, she didn't get to finish it. But I think that she was definitely a woman who lived before her time. She's my hero.
My guest is actress Mariska Hargitay. Here's a scene of her mom, Jane Mansfield, in that 1957 film, Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter? Tony Randall plays Rockwell Hunter, an advertising man trying to save his career by getting a sex symbol to endorse a brand of lipstick. Mansfield plays the movie star Rita Marlowe, who agrees to do the ads, provided Hunter pretends to be her new lover. In this scene, the two are in a car discussing their agreement.
We certainly appreciate what you're doing for the agency, Miss Marlowe.
Oh, forget it. Now all we have to do is to make you into a great lover.
Great what?
Well, at least you're going to have to look like a great lover so I'll look good. Would I pick on someone who wasn't the greatest? No.
Oh, I wouldn't think so. Not with those measurements. But you did.
Don't sell yourself short, Dolly. You know your way around a kiss.
I'm sorry about that. I don't know why it happened. Everything was happening so fast. Something snapped.
Something snapped? You snapped, and you're not a bad snapper, Dolly. I know. I've probably been snapped at more than any girl in history, except that communist queen, you know.
Catherine the Great?
Yes, yes, her.
Well, she wasn't a communist. She was a Tsarina.
I don't care what was wrong with her.
That's Jane Mansfield and Tony Randall in the 1957 film Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter? We'll be back with Mariska Hargitay after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Mariska Hargitay. She plays Detective Olivia Benson in Law & Order SVU. The new season premieres tonight. When we left off, we were talking about her parents, bodybuilder Mickey Hargitay and actress and sex symbol Jane Mansfield. Mansfield was killed in a car crash in 1967. You got into acting, I gather, in high school and began to make a career for yourself, did a lot of television. I'm wondering, being a child of a sex symbol, did that affect the roles that you chose? Did you decide you wanted to take a different course?
I did in the beginning a little bit. That was a little over. I think that was the one part that was a little overwhelming of being the daughter of a sex symbol and having people constantly compare you. And I was not a fan of that at the beginning. And so I definitely, I think, sort of gravitated toward, you know, more tomboy roles. One of the first parts that I ever played was a girl named Jessie, who was an ex-con on a series called Downtown. And I grew up with two brothers, so I think part of it was that too, you know, and I was sort of an athlete and a jock, and I loved sports. And, you know, my dad also was like an Olympic speed skater, and my dad is an amazing athlete, and so were my brothers. And so I think that I sort of followed in those footsteps as opposed to using my feminine wiles, if you will.
Oh, yeah. Well, your dad was Mr. Universe, wasn't he?
Mr. Universe, Mr. America, and Mr. Olympia in 1955. He held three titles.
Yeah.
My dad's a bit of a superhero, I have to say.
Right. And yet, I read, do I have this right, that you were actually named Miss Beverly Hills in 1982?
You read it right. Not something I talk about, but yep, you read it right.
Was that a beauty pageant?
It was.
And so you weren't so much a tomboy that did you enter that as sort of a lark
goof?
A goof? Yeah.
Yes. I thought it was funny, and somebody said, "Come on, do it. It'll be fun." And then I did it, and I realized that wasn't the road for me.
All right. So you wanted to survive on your acting wiles and not be a babe. I read that you once lost a part because you refused to dye your hair blonde. Is that right?
Yes, I did. A couple, actually. You know, which, by the way, now I think that I would probably do things differently now, because if it was a great part. But when I was so young, I mean, there was a lot of comparing to my mother. You know, everything was about her, which I understand, because they didn't know me, nor had I proved myself. But I really just wanted to do it my way. And so what if it took me 20 years? I did it.
Well, you've done well. I mean, you were in a lot of different TV series, in the 80s and 90s, including Can't Hurry Love. That was in the 90s, right?
Yes.
And did well, but was canceled.
Yes.
And kind of a breakthrough was getting on ER. You were, Cynthia Hooper, who was Dr. Green's girlfriend, right? Very different role from who you are you were sort of needy and kind of weak and mousy.
Yeah. Well, it was my favorite. It was absolutely like my favorite role. I mean, when I got that part, I just felt it in my bones. Like, I had so much fun. I went, oh, this is what acting is. You get to, you know, put on this other hat. And I had worked on it so hard. And obviously the cast was stellar and amazing. And Anthony Edwards was so good. So we really got to play. And I had so much fun on that when I was done, I thought, where do I go from here? Where am I going to go? I mean, it was so great, because they also, ER is obviously a drama, but they let me sort of go into some crazy territory. I mean, I got a little bit psycho, and there were some comedy moments. I mean, they really let me do whatever I wanted.
And gave you confidence, I guess. And then,
yeah, absolutely. And after, when I finished that show, I was working with DreamWorks and developing my own show. And then SVU came along. It was actually called Sex Crimes at the time. This script came in, and again, I've had that same feeling I did when I read the ER part, where I thought, this is mine. I know it. I feel it. I love this. I want to do this. This is huge.
Well, I read that you were really aggressive in pursuing that role with Dick Wolf to send the other actresses away, something like
well,
that.
What happened was, I went in and I had a few readings before I actually met with him. And I went in and I met with him, and we had a great, great meeting. And I read it, and then he gave me a note. I remember I said, "Do you want to tweak it?" And he goes, "No, you're fine." And I said, I live in the other side of the hill. And I said, I didn't drive myself all the way out to the valley not to get tweaked. And he goes, okay. So he gave me this note. And then we read the scene again. And it was so funny because he gave me a great note. But normally, you know, I instead of him saying, like, that was good, I said to him, that was good. That was a good note. So he was like, wow, this girl's got chutzpah. So I left, and then they called me to come back before I went to the network. Usually sometimes they just want to read it with you before you have your test at the network. So I went in, and I was thinking it was just a formality. Well, there was another girl there, and I didn't understand. And so I walked into the room. I go, what's going on? I said, this is my part. Tell her to go home. Now, it turns out that the other girl, who was wonderful, and she was gorgeous and extremely talented, turned out she was in the pilot as well. She was reading for the other role. But I didn't know that at the time. So anyway, the rest is history, and it all worked out. But I said to him, you know I'm right for this part. Let's not even get crazy.
Right. Well, I
send her home and let's go.
Yeah, I wonder if part of it was that you showed the kind of brass you'd want in a detective, maybe.
Well, we'll never know, but it was pretty great.
You know, I wanted to ask one other question about your mom, and this is a little serious, and if it's too personal, you don't have to answer it. But I know that you were actually in the car in the accident when your mother was killed, and were you and your brothers and were not hurt, and you were so young that I understand you have no memory of it. But I'm wondering if that accident, you think, affected you in some way, or the loss affected you in some way that you carry with you.
Well, of course it did. Absolutely. I think the most traumatic thing that can happen to a child is the death of a parent. And I think that obviously being in the car, I don't remember it in my mind. I can't. Thank God. I think that's my body's way of protecting itself from the horrific incident. But I think that we have, you know, muscle memory and definitely cellular memory. So, sure, I think it informs who I am as a person, and I think I will always carry that with me.
And, you know, this character that you play on SVU, you know, is the product of a terrible trauma. I mean, do you think there's some way in which you draw on that in the character?
Without a doubt, I carry that with me. I think it is the reason that I can play this character, that I understand this character, I'm grateful that I can, if I can touch somebody with that it's not all for naught.
Well, Mariska Hargitay, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Actress Mariska Hargitay from the series Law & Order SVU. The new season begins tonight on NBC. Coming up, two new comedies worth watching. This is Fresh Air. The new fall TV season for commercial broadcast networks begins this week, and TV critic David Bianculli is here with his choices for the season's best shows.
Last season, the two best shows introduced by the broadcast networks were very original dramas, ABC's Lost and the same network's Desperate Housewives. By the way, I don't accept the way Housewives was nominated for Emmys in the comedy category and even won some. It's a very funny series. But when viewers care that much about solving the central mystery in an hour-long show, that show is a drama, just like Twin Peaks. But I digress. The best thing about Lost and Desperate Housewives, other than their excellence and originality, was that they were both scripted, Writers wrote them, actors acted in them, and directors directed them. It reversed the tide of reality TV shows, and that was a wonderful thing. This season, that good fortune continues. And this season, there's no argument about the category in which to place the year's two new best shows. They're both comedies. Hilarious ones. Both of them are heavy with first-person narration, showing the central characters looking at their lives from a somewhat detached perspective. Both comedies are filmed single camera, rather than in front of a studio audience. Neither comedy has a laugh track. And neither one needs it, because you'll be laughing out loud without any prompting. These new comedies are My Name is Earl, which premieres on NBC tonight, and Everybody Hates Chris, which premieres on UPN Thursday. Both shows are in tough time slots on very competitive nights, and neither is likely to finish the season as a hit show, as did Lost and Housewives a year ago. But seek them out and embrace them. My Name is Earl stars Jason Lee, the jealous band member in Almost Famous, as Earl Hickey. Earl is a Southern fried outlaw, a low-life loser whose low life consists of stealing from people, getting drunk with his equally aimless brother, and putting up with his unfaithful wife, who tricked him into marriage one drunken lost weekend. Here's how Jason Lee, as Earl, recounts that whirlwind romance. Jamie Presley plays the woman in question, introduced to us, and to him, with the two of them in a passionate lip lock at a seedy bar.
About 6 years ago, I was out drinking when I met this little firecracker.
You got great boobs, Peggy.
Her name was not Peggy.
My name is Joy.
You got great boobs, Joy. She kept buying me drinks, and later that night, she drove us to Vegas. By the time I sobered up, we were married. The next morning, I was recuperating from being a little overserved.
Morning, Happy.
Hell, when I was drinking, I just thought she had a bit of a belly. Some people might think getting so drunk you accidentally marry a woman that's 6 months pregnant is a good reason to stop drinking. Personally, I think it's a good reason to keep drinking.
Earl's life changes when he wins the lottery, but not because of the money. He loses that in about 10 seconds. Literally 10 seconds. And ends up in traction in the hospital. It's there, waking up to the TV show Last Call with Carson Daly, that Earl hears a conversation about karma. When he's released from the hospital, he explains his life's new direction to his brother Randy, played by Ethan Suplee, and their new friend the motel maid Catalina, played by Nadine Velasquez.
Do good things and good things happen to you. Do bad things and it'll come back to haunt you.
That's deep, Earl. So why don't you stop hogging them Vicodins they gave you? We can all chat about that for a while.
I'm talking about karma.
Who's karma?
I don't know. Something Carson Daly came up with. He says he does good things in life, and that's why his life is so great. Got me thinking. My life sucks, and I ain't ever done anything good I can think of.
Who is this Carson Daly? Is he some sort of spiritual leader? A holy man?
You never seen TRL? You need to start putting on some of these TVs when you're cleaning the toilets.
If I want a better life, I need to be a better person.
What's this?
I made a list of everything bad I've ever done.
Why?
Why? Randy, I just won $100,000 in the lottery and was immediately hit by a car. I almost died because something good happened to me that I didn't deserve. That karma stuff is going to kill me unless I make up for everything on that list.
It's a great premise for a sitcom, and creator Greg Garcia makes the most of it. Jason Lee, as Earl, is absolutely charming, and Jamie Presley, in her over-the-top trailer trash way, is too. Put Earl on your list while he's working through his. The other sparkling new sitcom is Thursday's Everybody Hates Chris. The title, of course, is a play on the just-departed Everybody Loves Raymond, and this show's secret weapon is that the Chris in question is Chris Rock. Everybody Hates Chris is like Chris Rock's version of The Wonder Years. He doesn't appear in the show, but he narrates it, looking back on his own childhood and describing it from an adult perspective. The year is 1982. Chris is 13, and played by the perfectly cast Tyler James Williams. Chris is bussed across town to be the only black kid in an otherwise all-white school, and it isn't long before he runs into the school bully in the hallway.
My mother thought going to a white school meant I would get a better education and I would be safer. Wrong! That's Joey Caruso, a little thug with a big chip on his shoulder. You know, I managed to avoid him before I wore these shoes.
Nice shoes, Bojangles.
Bojangles? That's not what your mother called me when I was tap dancing in her drawers last night.
I know you think I'm crazy, but if I let him get away with that, he'd be doing it all year. Now, I couldn't beat him, but I thought maybe I could outblack him.
What? Did I stutter?
Do you know who I am?
You step on my shoe again, and I'm gonna tell you who I am. I don't play that. I'm from Bed-Stuy, boy. I'll bring half of Marcy up in here. I will beat your butt so bad, you're gonna need crutches in your sleep.
Hey, this might work.
It doesn't work. But the unavoidable after-school fight, like everything else about Everybody Hates Chris, is a delight. As the fight goes on in slow motion, and on and on and on, the show plays Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder's Ebony and Ivory on the soundtrack. Terry Crews and Tashina Arnold play Chris's parents. They're commendable role models, and they're very funny in their own right. Chris Rock and Ali LaRoy, who co-created the show, have done something important here. The dad at the head of this household actually matters. You look for strong, loving patriarchs on black family sitcoms, and once you get past John Amos on Good Times and Bill Cosby on The Cosby Show, that list pretty much stops. But Everybody Hates Chris isn't just culturally significant. It's got its own voice, the voice of Chris Rock, and it's a unique voice. Yet what it shares with My Name is Earl are a structure and a sensibility that make both shows refreshing. They come from opposite sides of the racial spectrum, black sass and white trash, but they meet where it counts. They're a riot.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, veteran actor Alan Alda. He got an Oscar nomination for The Aviator. He's playing a Republican presidential candidate on West Wing. And he has a new memoir called Never Have Your Dog Stuffed and Other Things I've Learned. Join us for the next Fresh Air.